You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to trash since 1977.
All right, everybody, welcome to the GGTMC. And yes, as always, you can all eat, have the roast beef.
Indeed.
Yes, Lorenzo. All right. Have to go back in the history of the show to know what that means. For those of you who stuck with us, thank you very much. For those of you that are new, I'm sorry. No, I'm saying welcome. Welcome. No. All right. I'm Sammy. He is Toddy. So have yourself a Sammy Toddy. And we will get around to reviewing some films this week. Todd picked one at random. He had heard good things about The Taste of Violence, 1961, directed by one Robert Hossein, which, honestly, I had never seen, nor did I know of.
Nope, me neither. And we got it. We have our good friend Shiftless and Shasta to thank for this.
There we go. A man that I think is challenging himself to see every movie ever made.
I do believe so, and let me tell you something, he's well on his way.
Yeah. He watches a lot of films.
It amazes me, and not only that, the amount that he actually is able to retain from them, I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Yep, impressive. And The Big Knife, which is an Arrow Academy release, 1955, directed by Robert Aldrich, who has been on the show before, with a cast of characters that have been on the show before, Jack Palance, Rod Sterling.
Steiger?
Yeah, or Steiger, yeah, Sterling. give me Yeah, you know.
Started early.
Yeah, here we go. Yeah, Ida Lupino as well.
A man with platinum blonde hair.
Yeah. A man with platinum blonde hair. That was my Johnny Carson, Rod Sterling.
Hi-yo.
And then Shelley Winters and a couple other folks. We'll get into it.
Yeah.
We'll get into that as well. But that is the gist of the show. Let's get into what we've been watching. What have you been watching lately?
Oh, boy. Okay, did I do Filmworker? 2017? About Leon Vitali, the guy who was basically Stanley Kubrick's assistant.
I want to think that you did, but that's okay. Because I saw it. But yeah, I think you did. I think you did.
Okay, we talked about then. I will skip that one, but I will just say this in brief. Go see it. Yes. And I also did Forced Vengeance, right? Yes. Chuck Norris?
Yes, you definitely did that one. So
okay. Le Silence de la Mer, Jean-Pierre Melville, 1949, about a Nazi officer played by Howard Vernon who gets put in the house with a couple of French people, and they basically try to freeze him out. And it's really an interesting movie in Melville's career. It certainly, you know, he relies a hell of a lot on visuals more than anything else, as he did a lot, but more with heists as he went later and later in his career, or I should say set pieces. But it is also really interesting as a kind of juxtaposition to Army of Shadows, which would come out, you know, what, to 15 years later, give or take. I think, no, that was 69, so it would have been more like 20 years. Regardless, it's really, really interesting, really well shot. For those of you who are not into a slow burn or movies that have, you know, that have a lot of quiet moments, I would say that's probably not for you. It's certainly not a war film in the strict sense. It's more about, you know, the people. It's about the people who were involved, the people who were fooling themselves about what they believe they were doing, and the people, you know, just how they come together despite their differences. They find some sort of common ground. So pretty high recommend. But yeah, definitely not for everybody. I could see that. Went on a rewatch with the Friends of Eddie Coyle, 1973. Great stuff, as always. Mr. Mitchum kicking ass and taking names, along with Alex Rocco and company, Peter Boyle, all of them. Great little crime film set in Boston, I do believe, if I'm remembering right.
Yes.
And has the great Stephen Keats in it. Keats in it? Keats. Stephen Keats. So for those of you who like Stephen Keats, this is the movie for you.
Keats.
I think it's K-E-A-T-S, right? Keats. But yeah, no. For those of you who haven't seen this, you really, really need to see this. You don't see it really spoken of much in larger circles, but in genre film circles, you definitely see it talked about a lot because it definitely gets a lot of respect, and righteously so. Followed that up with Collateral Damage from 2002 with Mr. Arnie Schwarzenegger, and it is as bland as bland gets. Wow, this thing was just kind of laid there. Not much going on. The plot, even for a film of this nature, is just beyond dumb. It feels just padded to hell. And of course, it's, you know, ridiculous beyond any sort of suspension of disbelief can be done. The circles that Arnie's allowed to walk in with like no real checks on him. So yeah, I would skip that. But I wanted to see it just to see what he got up to before he, went and became the governator. Followed that up with, The Enforcer, Jet Li, 1995. And, this was decent. Not great, but decent. It stars, you know, Lee and that little kid who was in New Legend Shaolin with him. Directed by Corey Yoon. And yeah, I mean, the action scenes in this, I mean, obviously are what you come for, and those are outstanding. Everything else is your standard Chinese crime melodrama, which just kind of falls flat. But the action scenes are really, there's something to see, especially in the especially at the finale when he's actually swinging the kid around, smacking people with him. So. if you're dying to see something like that, hey, this is the movie for you. So there was that. And then there was this, Cemetery Without Crosses, 1969, Mr. Robert Hossein starring and directing, and I believe possibly writing as well. And this, I was blown away. I was looking forward to it for a long time, had it sitting on the pile for a long time, finally watched it, and just insanely, insanely in love with this thing. Okay, maybe not the second insanely, but the first one. the first one definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got great faces. It's, you know, got a great little story. It's simple. It's beautifully told. And we'll get into a little bit more about, you know, what I think of Hossein when we get to our interview, or not our interview, our review in a little bit. So yeah, no, if you haven't seen Cemetery Without Crosses, you like Westerns or even just film in general, I would say absolutely seek this thing out because it is absolutely worth it. Followed that up with the first movie in the Stray Cat Rock box set, Delinquent Girl Boss. And this one is, it is what it is. It's a Nikatsu, you know, kind of pinky violence movie, and it didn't blow my doors off, but it's entertaining for what it is.
Yeah,
I mean, I still kind of, my favorite of the entire genre that I've seen so far, which I will be honest, is not a, you know, is not a comprehensive list by any means, would be Terrifying Girls High School Lynch Law Classroom, I think it was called. But I love the shit out of that one.
It sounds like a direct literal, you know, direct translation of a title.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's the great thing about Japanese titles is the way that they just kind of, yeah, the phrasing is everything. But yeah, this was fun. And, you know, it's got some cute girls in it, and it's got some violence, and it's got a lot of gangsters getting killed and girls riding motorcycles and being in a gang and all that fun stuff. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to more in the box set. But, yeah, this one, good, not great. Finally, forced myself to watch The Replacement Killers, and it is everything bad about the 90s, as far as I'm concerned. I don't think that American filmmakers ever knew how to use guys like Chow Yun-fat properly, or how to translate what they were taking from Hong Kong action cinema at the time into something that would be palatable to mass American audiences. And I think that movies like this and The Big Hit and all that sort of thing really kind of display that massively, even though this was directed by an American, Antoine Fuqua, a guy who, you know, I'm not all that enamored with to begin with. I liked his Equalizer movies, and that's pretty much all I can think of that I've either seen and or care about in his filmography. Not that I'm not open to other stuff, but so yeah, there's this, there's Mira Sorvino, who obviously is there because she was dating Tarantino at the time, and he said, hey, you got to be in this because Chow Yun-fat's in it. And yeah, it's just it is as standard gets. And yeah, it was I'm not gonna say I regret watching it, but so went over to Dynamite Brothers, 1974, directed by one Al Adamson. And I think that's really about all the review that you really need to know about it. If you've seen an Al Adamson movie, this is an Al Adamson movie. It just has James Hong and Aldo Ray in it. It's a mashup of kung fu and blaxploitation. Kind of has a little bit of a Defiant Ones angle to it. And then is just, you know, really kind of dull and padded, and with some really, really kind of brutal bits of violence here and there. So, yeah, Al Adamson is as schlock as schlock gets, and this is that in spades. If that attracts you, then this is the movie for you. Yeah. So, yeah, but personally, will I ever need to watch or think about this movie again? No, not for me. Mm. And that pretty much brings me up to date, sir.
Nice. Yeah, I remember I saw Replacement Killers in the movie theater. I remember, of course, I've only seen it one time.
Well, I would have, you know, back then I certainly would have been wanting to see it in the movie theater, but I don't think I definitely didn't.
I'd be curious to see it now. I do like Fuqua as a director.
Okay.
As a stylist, I should say. I don't know if he's a great filmmaker, but he's certainly one of the better commercial stylist filmmakers, I think, out there.
Okay.
Doesn't necessarily mean anything. I have no interest in his Magnificent Seven remake, and
no.
But I think I liked his Tears of the Sun, the Bruce Willis film, and I think I liked Replacement Killers. I think that was the first one. He came from that. I think he came from either that David Fincher commercial world, or he came from the Michael Bay one. He came from one of those two, though.
If I had to guess, I would probably say Michael Bay.
Yeah, that's what I want to say. Okay, I didn't watch much. I did catch up on Doom Patrol. I'm all caught up there. Caught up again last night. With
last episode was fantastic.
Oh, talking about the Beard Hunter, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh. in what era do I live in that the Beard Hunter exists in a physical form now? It's this era right here.
Yep. There's not many shows that I've seen lately that actually made me kind of cringe a bit when he digs in the sink for something.
Oh, my God.
I was like, no. And then I kind of rolled over a little bit there.
Please, God, no, is what I think I said in my head. And I do believe I did turn my head once it approached the mouth, because I'm just it's not something I want to deal with. Ugh. But I did watch one other film. I watched the Standoff at Sparrow Creek. It's kind of a small film. I think man, it had a bit of a buzz on some of the film, some of the festival circuits and stuff. Stars James Badge Dale, Brian Garrity, Patrick Fischler, a few other folks. It's basically a kind of a paranoia type thriller about a militia that you know, they all kind of get turned on their heels when there's a shooting that happens at a police funeral, and they're a local militia, and it's kind of Reservoir Dogish in a way. And but the dialogue isn't too Reservoir Dogish, so it's kind of a good, in my opinion. I mean, it wasn't a great film, but it was definitely a good kind of one or two location. You know, I mean, there's more locations than that, but it feels like it was shot in like a big warehouse. And it's well written. The director's Henry Dunham. This is kind of like one of the first things he's done. So I'm looking forward to what else he does. It's very well acted, I will say that. A real good performance from James Badge Dale in the lead. And then Chris Mulkey, I believe is his name. Character actor. I think he was on In the Heat of the Night and stuff like that. He's in this as well. And he's, you know, you've seen him before. He's been in a million things. But he's really good in the film. There's a lot more people in the cast that shows here than I actually feel like are in the movie. But there's some good monologues, some good fun to be had. And obviously there's some political slants in here. The only difference is they're not cops, so nobody has anything to really say about this film as opposed to the other one, or that doesn't have Mel Gibson in it, so nobody has anything really to say. But that's the only real difference I can think of. I gotta know now what else Antoine Fuqua's done, because you got my brain racing.
I think he might have done Training Day.
That was the big one. That was the one that kind of...
That was the one that everybody... Yeah, that everybody goes that, nuts over.
Yeah, that was the one that got him over the top.
That, Southpaw, Olympus Has Fallen, Shooter... Olympus
Has Fallen. Is that the one with Gerard Butler in it?
Gerard Butler in Olympus Has Fallen, yeah.
Oh, I like Olympus Has Fallen. It's ridiculous. I like it.
I haven't seen it, but I'd be interested. Like I said, I liked his Equalizer movies. I thought they were a lot of fun.
He's got a lot of credits. Oh, that's why. I know why. He's got a lot of credits because he did a lot of videos. Okay, so Replacement Killers is 98, and then he did Bait, Training Day. Training Day got him over the top, I think. Tears of the Sun, which I dig. Oh, he did that King Arthur. There's a King Arthur he did. Shooter, yeah, Brooklyn's Finest. Some people like that. I've never seen it. Olympus Fallen, Equalizer, Southpaw. I never saw Southpaw. Meant to.
No.
Not a whole lot, but yeah, enough.
No, I honestly thought that his he would have been a little more... prolific, to be honest.
It's like he's working with Chris Evans next. So, Antoine Fuqua, fun name to say. Fun to say Fuqua.
Fun to say it the wrong way.
Yeah, Antoine Fuqua.
Fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah. But that's about it. I didn't watch much else. I had good intentions and meant to watch other stuff, but my job likes to ruin my life. So, you know, that's the way it goes. I mean, you know. Got to work. Got to have money. At least that's what I hear anyway. So I don't even know if you really got to work and have money. I think you just got to have insurance. Especially the older you get, and if you have children, you got to have insurance. Got to have some of that insurance there, bae. And it sucks. But yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything else to talk about. Don't want to skim too much on the opening. I'm trying to think if there's any. No, don't think so. Pretty much it. We always kind of mention Doom Patrol a little bit, but yeah, definitely check that out. The Beard Hunter is something to behold. And I should say the right level of comedy on that too, on that play they have there.
Oh yeah.
Coffee. All right. So with that being said, we'll take a short break. And do we want to go? I guess we'll go chronological, huh? We always do.
That works for me.
So we'll come back and do the big knife. Robert Aldrich, 1955. We'll be back right after this. We'll be right back. right. Little Maiden there.
Woo.
Yeah.
Flash of the blade.
Yeah. That's me doing Bruce Dickinson when I shouldn't be. I do have those kind of I have those tight pants on, though.
I could listen to Steve Harris play all day.
Yeah. I always like this. What I liked about this song is I always liked the riff.
But I love the drums.
Yeah.
The drums are fantastic.
Yeah. And I never thought this, like, you know, it's not one of the most memorable songs. The chorus is great.
Yeah.
That chorus is great. That's very Iron Maiden, but the verse music has always been a problem for me. So, but still, good song. Good song. Good album. Great album, Power Slave.
Great too. Album. Yes. Yeah.
All right. Let's turn that off. Move on with our lives, which is going to involve The Big Knife from 1955, directed by one Robert Aldrich. Hollywood actor Charles Castle, is pressured by his studio boss into a criminal cover-up to protect his valuable career. Now, we should say this film has a bit of a... Well, it had a bit of a tough time getting out or making any real money, getting released, because it had ties to Hollywood and things like that. And Hollywood at the time really didn't like for you to criticize Hollywood.
Well, they still don't. But.
Man, they still don't really like it, but you can get away with it more now than you used to.
Sure.
This is kind of the waning the years of the studio system, 55 into the 60s. So, but this is kind of based a little bit on a John Huston incident that actually kind of took place a long time ago. So you can look it up and say what you will about that. We won't get into that on here. That's a whole other story. But if you look into that, I found out about that watching some documentaries on John Huston. So I found it kind of interesting. This is kind of roughly based on something like that. So, But this has got a big time cast in it, as far as classic Hollywood actors go. As far as method actors go, we should say, right? I think Jack Palance, I believe, and I believe Shelley Winters and Rod Steiger are all method people, if I'm not mistaken. So,
well, it's Steiger definitely.
Oh man, he's only in the movie roughly maybe 10 or 15 minutes in total, maybe even less than that.
Yep.
And but when he's there, he's there.
Yeah. Well, the cast all the way around, aside from, you know, there's basically what, like five faces. There's Palance, Winters, Lupino, Steiger, and what's his name? Sloan, Everett Sloan. Mm-hmm. And Gene Hagen, who everybody would, of course, remember from Singing in the Rain as the ditzy blonde.
Yeah.
But... You know, outside of that, the other guys are just really, you know, outstanding character actors. Yeah. Like the guy who plays Mickey, Nick Dennis, you know, does a great little job being kind of, you know, he's kind of a stereotype, but at the same time, he's a really important character. He's one of the few people who Castle actually, you know, likes and who likes him.
Yeah. And then, of course, Gene Hagen, we just talked about her about a month or so ago, right, with Panic in the Year Zero, so... It's funny. It's funny that she's playing a sex pot in this one, and she is quite sexy. But the sexiest handle of a back scratcher I've ever seen. And but then, you know, I think about her in Panic in the Year Zero, and she's very motherly and well, depends on your taste, but the very opposite of the kind of sex pot type role.
Go on. I'm talking. Listening.
Yeah. But so let's get into it. I'll let you lead on this one. See what you thought of The Big Knife. Is this first time seeing it?
No. I've seen it before.
Oh, nice. This was the first time seeing it for me, so.
Oh, okay. Then I'm very interested to hear what you have to say.
Well, pleasant experience. I will say that. I had a very, 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 very good time with The Big Knife.
Okay. All right, so movie starts off with a voiceover a la The Twilight Zone. Hey, we were just talking about Rod Steiger, Steiger earlier. yeah. Or a la, you know, Twilight Zone or Dragnet.
You watch it, Charlie. You're going to get a lot of Rod Steiger impersonations today.
Failure is not permitted here. Yeah. It's
totally a Rod Steiger type role, too. Like, I can just see him coming to Robert Aldrich saying, look, I'm going to wear this earpiece.
Yep.
I'm going to wear this hearing aid, and I'm always going to wear this suit, and I'm going to dye my hair blonde.
Yep. But like blonde.
Yeah.
Like Rita, what the hell was Harlow, Jean Harlow.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Blonde.
Yep.
And it's fantastic. It's a great look for him. But it opens up with, you know, pretty much the theme of the movie, which is failure is not permitted here. So first things first, the first scene with Palance in it, which, who, by the way, it's just a quick aside, is he used to own property like 10 miles away from where I live.
Yeah, Wilkes Barre there, huh?
Well, he was he had a place down in the area called Drums.
Yeah. Big farm?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, he was pretty much exactly as you would imagine Jack Palance was, especially at that point in time. He didn't really, he was kind of standoffish, but
he is what he is. He's born in Pennsylvania, right? Coal miner's son. So,
yep.
So I think he died. I know he died in California. So I imagine he probably spent time between California and, his hometown, kind of like Charles mm-hmm. Bronson, right? Cause I think Bronson have a farm in Vermont, though, I believe.
Bronson was never around this area that I'm aware of.
Yeah, he's from that. He's not from your area, maybe, but he is from Pennsylvania. But
yeah.
But I think that a lot of these kind of coal miner sons, a lot of those guys kind of came up in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of hardworking man's men kind of actors.
Yep, and they looked like it, too.
Palance, notorious for being method to a fault. Sometimes, and not so much in his acting style as in his physicality.
Mm-hmm.
If he was playing a boxer, you tended to really get hit. If he was playing a tough guy, he tended to really be an asshole to you. I mean, that kind of method type stuff. So from what I understand, and I've always heard this story, I don't know if it's true or not, Hollywood legend, but it's a great legend. He was the understudy to Brando on Streetcar Named Desire, on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And they were working out. This is back when Brando took real good care of himself and really cared about stuff like that, his looks and everything. And they were punching a punching bag. And one time, Palance accidentally missed the punching bag and punched Brando right in the nose. And Brando had to sit out a couple weeks, and Palance got to work as Streetcar. And then Palance moved on to be a leading man after that. So he kind of made his own way. And there's been some argument that maybe he punched Brando on purpose.
I can believe it. Yeah, I can believe it. One of his first big roles was Panic in the Streets, I believe. Yeah, or was that after this?
I don't know what his first big role was. I think the one that made him a star, the one I always think that made him a star was Shane.
Oh, God, yeah. That shot him into the...
Yeah, that's one of the great...
Another realm.
Yeah, that's one of the great bad guy roles of all time. That's just... And, of course, he has that striking face that only Jack Palance could have. It's almost like Charles Bronson's face. It's just... You can't really describe it.
It's sculpted out of marble.
Yeah, I'm looking through his filmography to see, but... Panic in the Streets would have been... Yeah, that would have been 1950, so that was like his third film. That's his first film, actually.
Well, yeah, because I think he was in like a couple of... He might have done a little bit of TV.
Yeah, and then he did Shane then, 3 years later.
Yeah.
So he only did a couple films. I think he did Halls of Montezuma, Sudden Fear, and then he did Shane. So he did... That's the four films. Panic in the Street, Halls of Montezuma, Sudden Fear, and then Shane. So both of those films kind of made him... But I would say Shane shot him into the stratosphere of...
Oh, God, yeah.
Yep. For those who haven't seen Shane... check it out, because Palance is well worth the price of admission alone.
Oh, easily. Yeah, he's the star attraction in that, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
The first scene that we get with Palance, we notice, I notice that he puts on his clothes while he's still sweaty. And that drives me berserk.
Yeah, it does drive me berserk, too. I can't stand that.
And he's wearing the shorts. Yes. He's the regular shorts he puts on underpants. It's like, really?
Yes.
So anyways, he plays a guy named Charlie Castle, and he is a guy who's, clearly jaded. Palance himself plays the role, constantly on boil. But for all of his kind of like grittiness, when he starts to talk about like his true friends, who are, very few, then you do get a sense that he's being very genuine. And I think that Palance, for as much as I like him, I think that he tends to, he runs very hot and cold in this thing for me. When he's really going for it with the histrionics and everything, then he kind of loses me a little bit, even though I'm loving the shit out of it. But when he's, being genuine with somebody and kind of, actually reaching out or having an actual moment with somebody, then you do really feel it. You fully get why this guy became as big as he did.
Yeah.
He was a great actor. Mm-hmm. So I mean you can't take that away from him.
Yeah.
So let's a couple other people in the cast here. You got Ida Lupino, who everybody knows as the lady who owns the farm in Food of the Gods, of course. But no, I'm kidding. She was, of course, an actress, and she became one of the earlier female directors in Hollywood.
Very solid one.
And very, very solid. Yeah, absolutely. And she plays his ex-wife. Well, kind of on the outs wife, I guess, because I don't remember whether or not they've actually gotten a divorce, but they're definitely on the rocks. And she's really great as a woman scorned, but you know, obviously she still has feelings for the Palance character, and she seems to gravitate to broken men, right? Because her fiance, who of course is a buddy of Palance's, is an alcoholic writer. And what she's kind of important to the film, even though her role is kind of underwritten, I think, to some degree. But, you know, it's interesting because she's also kind of the remainder of that little spark that used to keep Charlie going, right? Is his idealism, which they talk about, you know, at length in the film, you know, his idealism. And they talk about it very plainly at certain points of time. I mean, you could tell that this was at one point in time a play by Clifford Odets, by the way, for those of you who didn't know. Mm-hmm. And not just because it's, you know, it's very stagey in that, you know, there's what, a few sets and that's it. And most of it is inside of Palance's house. But I think that Steiger, of course, you know, it's the platinum blonde guy. And, he's great because he honestly doesn't have to do a thing to tell you everything you need to know about him. But then, you know, when he turns it on, you realize that, you know, he's cold, cruel, business always. He makes Charlie shake, and makes him act like a child in the very first scene, the very first scene of two, that Steiger is in. Mm-hmm. Palance just keeps kind of like, he's sitting on the couch and he's turning away and he can't look at him. And he really is like a child being scolded, by a guy who just is very dissatisfied with him, like a paternal figure, I guess you could say, that is, very disappointed in him. And Stanley, Steiger even says, I need your body, not your goodwill, which is a great line. I mean, that's fantastic.
There's a lot of good lines from Steiger in the film. I mean, I can see why he would take the part because one of my favorite things he does is like, I'm sorry, I speak with my eyes closed because it helps me to see.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's a great moment when he kicks back on the chair and mm-hmm. he chews up all the scenery he can in Rod Steiger style.
It's so much fun to watch.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is. I think that's what made him a great actor in the 40s and 50s is the fact that he could, like a lot of great stage actors, I think they come on the screen and they just, you know, tear everything apart.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was the acting style of the 40s and 50s. Some people don't like that style. This is very stagey mm-hmm. in a lot of ways because, like I kind of talked about with Standoff at Sparrow Creek, this is very sparse as far as locations go. It looks like they had like one house and maybe a couple other sets, but they really don't leave the house much. They really mostly are in Jack Palance's or Charlie's house.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, there's a couple other sets. There's a photo shoot. There's outside in the backyard. Mm-hmm. There's a brief little scene at a party at another place. But outside of that, there's really not. It's all in the house, and not even like both floors of the house. You know, mostly in this giant living room.
Yeah,
where he's got the bar where you could like kind of you walk down the steps to get to it, mm-hmm. which it's neat. I think that's really neat. So anyway, you get Gene Hagen, obviously, who shows up as a boozy cougar, which I was really enjoying the shit out of. And she's another person that has something to hang over Charlie, just like everybody else in the film seems to. And in that respect, I think the film has elements of film noir in it, right? It's got the man doomed by his past. It's got like a quasi femme fatale between Hagen, who's really only in like two scenes, and then Dixie Evans, played by Shelley Winters. It's got some stylized cinematography, but you know, despite those elements to it, and I do think that they are front and center, the film is really more of a psychodrama about, you know, this guy who's crushed by the system. And I don't even think it has to be the Hollywood system specifically, even though this is about the Hollywood system. You can extrapolate off of this, you know, the civilization or modern, well, let's call it modern society in general, just crushing, having the ability to crush people down.
Yeah.
I think that for all of its sort of earnestness and its venom, certainly, and its pity for the world that it portrays and the characters who inhabit it, it also is an extremely turgid melodrama. Yeah. I think that it's kept alive by its genuine moments, like I said, like the ones that the Palance has, and you know, whenever Steiger shows up, and then Aldrich's visual flourishes. And so, in that respect, for me, I think that it's a little long at almost 2 hours.
Yeah,
I think you do start to feel the weight of the time. Right around the hour and a half mark.
Yeah, that is because, the weakness of the movie. If there's the one major weakness of the movie, is like it is way, I don't know if it's way too long. We say that, but it is certainly
too
long.
Well, I think, you know, when we talk about a film being too long, obviously we're talking about pacing more than anything else, right? Yes, I mean, a well-paced movie can last 4 hours, and you really don't feel it at all.
Right.
But there's, you know, like I was saying, Aldrich has some great little things. Like there's this scene where I think it's when Palance is talking to his buddy Smiley Coy, who's kind of, he's one of those really interesting characters because he's kind of like a thug kind of right hand man, but he also kind of seems to have like another genuine relationship with Charlie. Like they have a certain respect for each other, whether it's just from their past together or whether it's that they were, you know, actually friends at one point in time. But anyways, they're talking and Palance is standing next to a lamp and he just keeps looking down into the light. And, you know, there's obviously this big bright light shining up in his face. And it's just this really great, really great look to it that screams film noir. So let's see. What else do I got here? You could see, I think, and I don't know if he's ever actually spoken with it specifically, but I think that you can see where Scorsese got part of his visual inspiration for Raging Bull. In the boxing picture, Charlie screens a boxing movie that he made for his friends, and there's scenes in there that, I mean, they are almost carbon copied into Raging Bull.
Yeah, I thought about that. I made a note of that. I don't know if this is the main influence. I do know that some of the boxing movies of the 50s, 40s, and 50s, a lot of them use that Dutch angle type thing.
Yeah.
So it's quite possible that stuff probably influenced Scorsese as a kid who grew up watching movies. No doubt. Yeah. But that's the first thing I thought of when I saw this. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you notice it hard.
Yeah.
And like you said, yeah, it was probably more an amalgamation.
I think the reason why you notice it so hard is kind of like similar to Raging Bull. You don't see a crowd.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? There's that. There's the smoke filled room with no crowd. It's just kind of like top lit.
Yeah.
You know, really gray. Mm-hmm. Then obviously the Dutch angles and everything else. In
right.
The
only thing it's missing is the animal sounds and the blood.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about Shelley Winters. So she comes into the movie and Charlie gets put in a position to kind of reach out to her as you know, I refer to them as being nails that can't be hammered down. And there's a scene between the two of them which starts off kind of disingenuous, but then, you know, you can see that he sympathizes with her because they're similar. But he's also concerned about what she knows about the kind of the background, the underlying thread of the film, which is this the secret that Charlie does not want to come out. And they make it pretty plain early on what the secret is. So it's just like kind of like a secret between these people. So, you know, they have this wonderful little scene together where she's kind of like, you know, she's shows that she's the female side of Charlie's dilemma, and she has it worse than he does. Like, he's being pressured to re-up a contract, where she's just kind of like being tossed around like a piece of meat, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Being used up and spit out. And nobody gives a shit about her or trying to help her career in any way, shape, or form. And I found that kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I
was thinking about that Scorsese thing. Now you think about it. I was thinking, I got there was a couple Score moments that I got that were Taxi Driver-esque. And then, of course, Saul Bass did the titles to this.
Yep. Oh, it's very jazzy.
So it's certainly a film that Scorsese has seen.
Oh, my God, yeah. Well, then again, he's one of those guys like Joe Dante that you're just like, is there a movie you haven't seen?
Well, yeah, right. I mean, you know, he's, you know, even though he went to film school, he's really him and Dante and those guys are some of the first generations of guys who grew up learning about movies by watching movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, no, they ingested it constantly. It was just a constant need that they had to fill. And then they projected it, you know, their interpretations up on screen. So they're, in a sense then, you know, in the end of the movie, by the time it all comes around, because after we have this big row and certain things happen and they all happen off screen, or I should say all of the real action, of the movie takes place off screen, or I should say the stuff that we would expect to be shown takes place off screen.
Yeah, this is a low budget movie.
Sure.
I believe it was shot in like 15 days.
Oh, I believe it.
So, a quickie.
So the end of the film obviously resolves this kind of conflict going on in Charlie. And I, you know, he becomes a realist in the end, as he has to, because what it boils down to, or at least the message that I kind of got out of it, was that, you know, idealism's great, but it can't be allowed to survive. And that's why I talk about, you know, the Hollywood system crushing people, but it doesn't have to be the Hollywood system, even though this is about that specifically. You know, it's one of those things where you get to the end and the truth, as they say, you know, might set you free, but it doesn't mean you get a happy ending. Mm. And that really is the summation of the film. And it, you know, the last few moments of the film are really spectacular, stylistically. I mean, it tells you everything in like one shot. And you know, then it plays out a little bit longer than that. And, I think it might just go a little bit longer than it needs to at that point. Although I do really like when Smiley makes the phone call immediately after the climax of the film and what he says, because it's all just kind of, you know, goes around in the little merry-go-round that they got going on there.
Yep. I like how Smiley calls everybody Kitty, too.
Yeah. well, I mean, that's pure 50s, right? Yeah.
What you got going on there, Kitty?
Uh-huh. So, yeah, I mean, it's got to, you know, I really didn't get into Everett Sloan, who is one of the great actors of his generation, I think. He was certainly one of Orson Welles' guys. I think he was in the Mercury Theater. Don't quote me on that. I might be wrong, but I don't think I am. He was certainly in Citizen Kane and a bunch of other productions with Welles. But he's a great he does a great turn as Charlie's manager. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's kind of playing ball and everything else, but then eventually he snaps, and like everybody else, he just becomes the kind of this shrinking violet, sort of wilting away. And you know, he becomes defiant, but at the same time, he's just, you know, kind of exhausted by everything. It's everybody's world weary in the film. Yeah. And I think that that's really the thing that that makes it stand out for what it is. But like I said, I mean, kind of the two main drawbacks for me are when it really goes for the melodrama, like really, really plays it up. I kind of start to lose interest a bit. And then, like I said, the pacing that makes it feel feel longer than it is, even though, yeah, it could definitely be shorn of a few minutes at least. But great performances mostly all the way around. You know, I like that when Palance really starts yelling, I mean, he does put you on edge, like when he really digs deep. And like gets that kind of primal yell going on here and there. I mean, it does put you on edge.
I've always kind of described him as like a shark on screen, right? Like he's this kind of, when he starts to breathe, like when he starts to get his temper up, his whole body moves. It's like,
yeah,
you know, and he's always kind of done that.
It's funny. It's funny. I've always seen him more like a rattlesnake.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, either way, it's an apex predator.
He has that hiss.
Yeah.
It's all, believe it or not.
There you go.
There's my Palance impression for the day.
He always had it, and he would use it, especially in the back end of his career. Man, he really, that impersonation is so spot on for the end of his career. Tango and Cash.
Pleasant Cash, it's Tango.
Yeah. And then, of course, his turn in Batman is very memorable.
Don't forget your lucky deck.
Yeah, which is funny because when I think about Batman, it kind of brought him back into the public eye. And right before that, he had made a sequel to Gore 2.
Which
it's crazy. He had went from the bottom back to the top.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. There's a movie of his that I cannot find anywhere. And it was a TV movie. It was made, I believe, by Rankin Bass, but it was called The Ivory Ape. And it was a Japanese co-production, I think. And it's him as a hunter after this albino gorilla. And I saw it once on TV when it first was aired. And like I said, I don't remember 100% if it was a TV movie or not, but I think it was.
Yeah.
But I have not been able to find this thing ever anywhere else.
Yeah. I think I've seen that on TV as well, oddly, because it's very memorable, the ape itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, it's a great, fantastic special makeup effects on that thing. Yeah. But then I also remember being really kind of disappointed by the ending of it, which I won't spoil for anybody who hasn't seen it, because I remember that vividly, although I don't remember anything else about the film. I've been dying to get my hands on a decent copy of that one, and I cannot find it for the life of me. Great, and while we're at it, you know, talking about actors who kind of went up and down, you know, Shelley Winters is, you know, she in this is, I think, fantastic. I think this is one of her best performances that I've seen. And, you know, she's obviously a woman who, when she is up to the level of her talent, she really shines, and she really shines here, you know, as opposed to something like, oh, I don't know, Tentacles or along that line.
Yeah, she can ham it up, but she.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah, she was really good. I mean, she was a really good actress, but she was also I don't know what the best way to describe Winters was. But she definitely was a character off the screen as much as she was on the screen. There's so many. Like devious sex stories about Shelley Winters that
are there?
Yeah, evidently are true. She was quite promiscuous and quite she had quite the good time.
And on that note, that's all I got.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a Faustian tale, right? I mean, that's basically what we got here. You know, guy that's protected himself, but I did enjoy the way the story was told. I totally agree with you that it is too long, but in saying that, it is a very solid film noir without all that film noir style, right? It's not, obviously it's low budget, so there is some camera stuff going on here, but it's not nearly as film noirish as I think some people might walk into it thinking.
Well, it lacks the trappings of noir. It lacks the gangsters, really, like the full on gangsters. It lacks, you know, the detective. It lacks actual on screen murder or murder plot, right?
Yeah, it's all about, you know, well, I won't say it's all about this because the Ida Lupino character seems to be trapped in it, but it's mostly bad people in a bad situation. I really liked, when I came out of this, what I really ended up liking was the Smiley character, the way that he was imposing with being, it's funny that his last name is Coy. So cause that, mm-hmm. that's what it reminds me of. He was very coy, but at the time he, you know, he's intimidating without being right in your face. Like, he's the real muscle behind the Stanley Hoff character.
Yep.
Oh, break you. But he is the real muscle. Like, you know, Stanley Hoff's an intimidating person because he's the speaker, you know. But the truth of the matter is, the guy you don't want to get on the bad side of really is Smiley Coy, because he's the one that makes stuff happen. And that's always the most dangerous person to any person that's got power, like Stanley Hoff does, the Rod Steiger character, because he needs somebody that'll actually do the dirty work. And that's one of the things I liked about Smiley the most. I like that he would come in and he just kind of, you know, says a few lines of dialogue and you're like, oh shit, man, stuff's about to get real. So that was a lot of fun. And he's really good in the film. I can't remember the actor's name off the top of my head.
Wendell Corey?
Yeah, Wendell Corey. Mm-hmm. Who I remember, sadly for him, I remember him from the Astro Zombies.
Oh, God, the Ted V. Michaels?
Yeah, it was one of his last films.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
But I remember him from that. I remember him from The Star Maker and a few other things. But, yeah, I remember when I saw him, I was like, where did I know this guy from off the top of my head? And sure enough, yeah. I looked through his filmography and I'm like, oh God, he was in the Astro Zombies. But he did a lot of other stuff, a lot of TV series stuff in the '50s, and was a good character actor. And he's like I say, he's really good in this. He looks like somebody that they would call Smiley, right?
Yeah. And with, you were saying, he's the muscle. It's kind of like, Jimmy Hart, the mouth of the South, right? It's like he's the mouth, and like the Hart Foundation is the muscle, right?
Yep. Which is funny you say that, because Steiger kind of looks like a professional wrestler at times in this film with his earpiece, and he almost looks like a manager or something. But yeah, he's really good in the film, and I like that one line of dialogue. Jack Bauer's Smiley, why do they call you Smiley? You never see you smiling. But I like the... I guess for me, these type of films, one of the things I like the most is I like the era, right? I mean, there's this dark side to Hollywood that we know existed. It was a grindhouse before they started using the word grindhouse. They would grind these pictures out, and before TV kind of took over. And this is the era when TV started taking over. So you really kind of, you know, you can make films like this and get away with it, but you had to start creating more spectacle because people had to have a reason to leave the house. And this is very much a thing that could have been on one of those Playhouse television shows in the 50s.
Yeah, right alongside Requiem for a Heavyweight, which I believe Palance was in as well.
Yeah, so this could have easily been that, because this could have been a, really, except for, like I said, a few moments, this could have been a one-set movie. The whole thing could have taken place in that living room or that kind of relaxing area that... the kind of recreational area that Palance had in his house. And it could have told the whole story right there. You could have just had characters come in and out, and the whole story could have been told, but they gave it a little bit of a Hollywood production value. I don't think, like I said, I don't think I've ever seen a back scratcher be so sexy in a movie. Pretty good. Gene Hagen really, really works it. And you touched on some of the other stuff. I mean, I feel like there definitely is some Scorsese-ness. I mean, like I said, I feel like he's definitely seen this. But the story is a very basic, simple story involving morality and questions. And like I said, some of the scenes that, you know, by the fact that they leave the house, like there's a scene on the beach with I think his son and Ida Lupino and a dog and the trainer guy. And it just seems it's a fine scene, but it just seems like it didn't even need to be there.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. No.
And there's a few.
I think
like
that's more just kind of to break it up.
Yeah.
More than anything else, I think.
And it really does, right? Because it's a totally different, unique moment in the film. That and the scene where he's at the studio. But I can buy the scene where he's at the studio because he has to do his work.
Yes.
And I don't buy that. Palance is a striking looking man, but I don't buy that he would be considered a a lead in the kind of sexy Hollywood kind of way.
No, they liked a much more European back
yeah,
then.
Yeah, yeah. But again, I mean, he's a striking looking person. I mean, there's no doubt about that. His face is super unique, and that's what made him so, I think, gave him the career it gave him, because, you know, it did. You know, obviously, he was going to be able to play heavies his whole life with that face. But I mean, I'm not saying he's not an attractive man. He certainly is good looking in this movie. I mean, you can see where he has that kind of rugged kind of sexuality. You could see where some women would be attracted to that. He's very physical. He's in good shape. He's kind of manly and aggressive, but obviously he's struggling with a lot of his stuff. And that's kind of the things I liked a lot. I like that, you know, he's obviously a full-blown alcoholic at this point, and I think they do a good job of playing him as an alcoholic without him doing any, like, super drunk acting. Because mm-hmm. Drunk acting was, you know, something that back in the old days was pretty bad.
Although in this, Winters does it well.
Winters does it well, yeah. Some would argue she probably went method because she was she probably was. But yeah, I liked all the character interaction, man, and I really liked the story. I think for me, I don't know if the MVT, I wrote down three MVTs. Sometimes I do this when I'm doing this show, and I wrote down, you know, Palance ? Steiger ? Or screenplay, because to me, what kept me going and wanting to not turn it off was the story was really good. I wanted to see where everything was going to shake out, and I really got kind of engulfed in the story and really liked it. I liked, actually, that it wasn't fully overblown, shot in shadows, and everybody wasn't smoking every 5 seconds. All that kind of stuff that, you know, you normally get in a film noir. Mm-hmm. And I liked that it was this kind of critique on Hollywood as well. This kind of bringing up the fact that it was a meat market. And arguably, it still is a meat market. I mean, if you're not bankable, if you're not sellable, what are you? You're just your luggage. You're a problem, and this is kind of a different era. Whereas I think, sadly, this says something about us as a race of people. I think nowadays, if you accidentally killed somebody in a car wreck, you'd probably get more work.
Yeah, you probably would.
Than you would ruin your career. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a sad state of affairs. But it seems like nowadays, you know, you make a porn tape or you do these things that were socially unacceptable back when people kept their privates to themselves and the private affairs to themselves, for that matter. Nowadays, tends to get you where you want to go. And I don't know what that says about us. I mean, I have my personal opinions, but it is kind of sad to me that that's what we've become. Not to sound like an old fuddy-duddy, but it does seem that way, that you can do something controversial nowadays and you know, you get work as opposed to before. I'm not saying that it ain't ever been there. It's been there before, but it's certainly escalated over the last couple decades.
Well, I mean, guys like Robert Mitchum kind of became much more popular after they got busted for weed, right?
Yeah. Yep. So. Yeah, I mean, it's always been there. There's always a piece of it. Mm-hmm. That's always been there. So it's not like, you know, you got to have something to sell. People, I mean, we all have morbid curiosity. I'd be sitting here, I would be lying to you if I sat here on my high and mighty throne and said, it's, you know, these stories, this blah, 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 about these people who do terrible things. You know, I'm better than them. I can sit here, but there's a morbid curiosity, right? I mean, somebody has a sex tape that leaks on the internet, I'm curious. If somebody that has, you know, some kind of dirty laundry aired out, I'm curious. I would be lying to you if I told you otherwise, because I think what that does, and this is where I do think this stuff is not important, but I think it hits all of us, is I think we're all human and we all have flaws. Mm-hmm. And I think when we see an actor fall or we see a celebrity or a politician fall, I think we're morbidly curious, because then we know that person's a human being. Then we know that person has issues. I think it's too easy to sell a box of goods with a movie camera and everything else. I mean, this goes back to the age-old thing. You know, we could talk about this like we talked about a few weeks ago with Mel Gibson. You know, I mean, yeah, he works great on screen. He's great on screen. He's a talented director. But the guy's obviously got some major issues. mm-hmm. and he's a human being. And I don't agree with hardly anything he stands for as a person. I don't. But that doesn't mean that I don't find him interesting to look at.
Yeah. Well, I got to wonder, you know, I agree with what you're saying, although I really got to wonder whether it's, you know, we like these sort of things because it makes the other person more human, or if it's because it takes them down a peg.
Oh, there's part of that
it brings
too.
Him down to our level, right? Well, that, like, that who makes does he think he is? Oh, well, yeah. He deserved that because, yeah. you know, high and mighty this, that, or he yeah. did that, or,
well, my you know. My idea of that, though, is that says something about
the person.
Oh, we
love Schadenfreude. I mean, yeah. come on.
That says something more about the person that's looking at the stuff than it says about the person that got knocked down a peg.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think you'd be hard pressed to be able to swing a dead cat without finding at least a group, possibly even 50% of the people who would react at all to these sorts of things mm-hmm. that wouldn't at least partially think that way.
Yeah. I mean, there's always people who, you know, like I think to myself when I was younger, when I was a teenage boy, and, maybe I would get jealous if a girl thought, some kid that was on a TV show was super attractive and her walls were plastered with pictures of him. Mm-hmm. You know, that era when we would all cut out magazine pictures and stick them on our walls and stuff. That's an age old thing right there. That really dates us. But the, I think about that and I think I would get a little jealous about it. Like, oh yeah, he's, you know, and then I wouldn't accept the fact that the person could act. I just hated him because the girl I liked at the time was infatuated with him.
Yep. Yep. And so I'm just picturing all the torn up Tiger Beat magazines yeah. on your bedroom floor.
Yeah. 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 Me crying in the middle of all these torn up pages. No,
no, you stop it, Corey.
But no, I think about that. And then of course there's a sense of maturity that comes with it. And this realization that we all have an issue, be it alcoholism, some type of addiction, devious behavior. Some of us cheat, some of us lie, some of us steal. Some of us don't do anything. But I'm just saying these are all human conditions. And this kind of goes back to what I'm saying, though, political correctness and everything else. I think there's certainly an era out there right now where people want their actors and there's celebrities and everything. There's this era out there now where people don't want to quote unquote support an actor if they've said something off color in an interview. And the truth is, you don't have to pay to go see their movie. They're still making money. They still have a career because somebody's going to do it anyway. You can make a stand. That's great. You made a stand, but you don't have to make everybody else make a stand.
That's the thing, though.
That's
right?
The thing. Yeah, I don't need your, you know, rigmarole. I don't need all that shit. To use a word that's
nice use of the word rigmarole.
Yes, to use a word that has nothing to do with our generation.
Say, what's the scuttlebutt?
But you know, anyway, but I like stories like this because I think I always like stories, and the reason why I like film noir is because you have, I think what film noir brought to cinema is the kind of human frailty of us all. The question, you know, there's a bag of money on the ground and a dead body. Do you take the bag of money and not report the dead body, or do you report the dead body and give the money back? So you get these moral quandaries, right? Yeah. And everybody's going to react differently. And then that leads to what is really, to me, the most important thing is the conversation. The conversation you have then, well, this is what I would have done. Well, this is what I would have done. And you don't need the judgment. Nowadays, I think everybody jumps straight to the judgment. I don't think anybody thinks about the quandary. I think they think about the end result. So I think that's what film noir gave us. And I don't think film noir works nowadays because I think we're a culture right now of extremes. You know, you either like it or you don't like it. You either hate it or you don't hate it. You either, you know, you're either Trump or you're non-Trump. You're either, you know, and it's our political environment. It's everything right now. It's, you know, it's social yeah. media. It's all that stuff. So,
well, I think that, I don't know. I think that noir could work now just because you would just have to have the balls
yeah.
to be able to dissect this stuff and, you know, be morally ambiguous or just kind of leave it, you know, open to the viewer to make some kind of a decision about the actions of the characters, which, hey, And I still haven't seen it, but you know, that could entirely be what we're talking about when we talk about a film like Dragged Across Concrete. Mm-hmm. Not to go bringing that into this more, but I think it's, you know, there. But I think it's because, you know, it's so black and white now that we need that. We need that gray more now. Whether it would be accepted, whether it would be popular, that's really open for debate. But I think that it could absolutely I think it could still work. Obviously, you would have to have the visuals to back it up.
Yeah, I don't think nowadays, just in the climate of filmmaking, or especially in the climate of populist filmmaking, mm-hmm. I think what comic book movies, unfortunately, have brought to the table is very much the old school white hat, black hat sometimes of the old Western in some ways. Mm-hmm. I think some of them try to do something differently, but I think the big ones, the real big ones, in my opinion, especially the Marvel films, they're very much white hat, black hat when you look at them.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. There's slight shades of gray, but I mean, by and large, yeah. It's a very solid line between good and bad.
Yeah, they're 80s action movies all over again, really.
Although amped up and, you know, blown out.
Yeah. Well, all of our action stars now have superpowers as opposed to before they just were indestructible.
Right.
Gunned enthusiast.
Yep.
that's the 80s action star, the indestructible gun enthusiast. That's a great name. That's a great name for a movie. Arnold Schwarzenegger is the indestructible gun enthusiast.
Smiley, take this down. Yeah.
Got a SAG clown picture in your lounge.
yeah, that's the other thing, is that that picture that you know, Aldrich makes very, very pointed efforts to keep in frame a lot when he's shooting in the near the bar.
Yep.
Is the, you know, it's a clown, but it's not your typical clown painting.
No.
And it's described in the film as being brooding. Yeah. So that, you know, kind of tells you a little bit more about.
I think I would classify more as terrifying, but
it is slightly terrifying. It's kind of Sir Francis Bacon-y, kind of.
Yeah, it's a little terrifying. Mm-hmm. So let me let's really don't have much more to add about the movie, but I'll talk about the disc a little bit. There is a commentary track and a few other things on the disc. But what I think really kind of the best thing about the disc, the Blu-ray, is it looks really, really nice. The transfer is really, really nice, and the film looks gorgeous. I didn't see any cracks or pops or anything. It looks like it's totally remastered as far as the movie goes, and it's in great shape. I mean, the movie is really in great shape, and I bring that up because we really couldn't have watched two more different transfers, I think, this week.
No, I don't think we could have.
Then the Big Knife and a taste of Violence. So. That's about all I got to add. I would definitely recommend people pick this up on Blu-ray and tell them, you know, write to Arrow and say the GGTMC sent you that way. So let's get into Make or Breaks, MVTs, and whatnot.
Alrighty. Make or Break for me is going to be the big finale, the showdown with Stanley. It really is just great watching this thing finally come to full boil and go over. And, you know, the final point where Palance steps up to him is just fantastic, and Steiger's reaction is just fantastic, and it really just brings it all home.
He like when he crosses those arms.
Yep I fucking loved it, because it is so note perfect.
Yeah, it is.
So there's that, and MVT, you know, as much as I appreciate what Aldrich brings to this, I think that Steiger really lights it up whenever he's on screen, so I'm going to give it to him.
Yeah.
And plus, I don't know how many more times I'm going to be able to give it to Mr. Steiger. So, and then score for me, I'm going with 6.5 out of 10. I'm going to say that you like this more than I do.
Yep.
But I still do enjoy it. I still do enjoy what it's doing, what it's saying, and how it's being said. Yeah, some really great performances in there. So I would agree that it's something that people should pick up. You don't have to just be a fan of noir, because like I said before, I mean, this is very tangential as far as strict noir goes. But it's definitely stuff in there. So
yep.
There's definitely those elements to enjoy as well.
Yep. All right, my MVT, like I said, I really like the story a lot, but I think I'm going to go with Palance. I do think he carries the weight of the movie on his shoulders. As the movie goes along, he becomes more and more stooped, for a better word. More and more, it feels like his back is being broke by the weight of everything that's kind of happening to him. So I'm going to go with Palance. I really love Rod Steiger in the movie, though, so I totally agree with you, and I really enjoy the screenplay. The only hang-up, really, for me, with this being a great movie, is the fact that, like you, I agree, it goes on just a little too long. There's too much filler, and it almost feels like it's trying to capture a runtime when it really didn't need to. It just feels a little long. My make or break, man, I really like that first Steiger scene with Palance. That's you pay to see stuff like that. That's the kind of thing you want to see. You want to see two actors go at it, and you want to have a good time. And really, you got four actors in that scene, but you got your two heavies, and you got your two very good character actors kind of in there too. And it's just a really great and well-written scene. The Smiley character at that point is not really very talkative. He's kind of, Wendell Corey's just kind of hanging out. He can tell he can tell he's somebody, but he's not really a big part of the story yet. He kind of comes along a little later. But it really is just great when Steiger sits down and closes his eyes and puts his feet up and starts talking. And, you know, like I say, it's very Faustian. It's very, you know, Robert Johnson at the crossroads. It's very much all that kind of stuff. You know, selling your soul, all that kind of thing. So, and I kind of like that. And my score for the film is 7.5. Yeah, I liked it more than you did. But I think it just has to do that. That's an era of filmmaking that I really enjoy, and an era of acting I really enjoy, when people were really hamming it up and they really go full tilt for it. So, don't really know. You know, I think it's more of a personal taste thing, right? But I mean, it's just, it is what it is. I still think 6.5 is a very fair score, though, because it has some flaws, no doubt. It's not perfect. Okay, that is our thoughts on The Big Knife. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about The Taste of Violence, which is a great title, from 1961, with directed by Robert Hussein. We'll be back right after this. Turning the music down and didn't turn my mic up. There we go. How about that, motherfuckers?
Yeah.
I just turned it right off. Fuck it. We're done.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Rebelling.
Well, it's just basically me fucking up, so you got to hear it live on the air. You're welcome, everybody.
No, rebelling.
Yeah, I'll say rebelling. All right. So our next film is The Taste of Violence, 1961, directed by Robert Hussein. This is a European Western, says so here in the thing. And it's set in an unnamed Latin American country, suffering under a dictator. There's a revolution underway. I think the dictator's daughter, girlfriend, wife.
Daughter.
Yeah, is kidnapped by some guerrillas. And they're trying to get all that stuff kind of taken care of. That's the basic plot synopsis. What's more important to GGTMC listeners is it not only has Robert Hussein in it, but it also has Mario Adorf in there.
Boom.
Who He plays a great Mexican, got to say.
Yep.
he looks the part, man. He really does. He looks good in that damn sombrero and that damn bandolero he's wearing across his body.
Although, you know, it's really weird. It's kind of disconcerting hearing French from people who are supposed to be Central Americans. Yeah. Even though if they were speaking English, it wouldn't have bothered me at all. Yeah. It wouldn't have been anything.
Yeah, this is the brim of this is like the precipice, I think, of this kind of world cinema that kind of took place in the 60s, right? The spaghetti western. So it's arguable, and I'll lead on this one, obviously, because you chose it, but this could arguably be seen as one of the first spaghetti westerns. If not,
it would have certainly been before Leone.
Yeah, and it kind of is that. It's not completely that because the style is kind of different, but it kind of goes back to that argument. I've read books on it and stuff. Savage Guns maybe might be the first one, or maybe Terror of Oklahoma or Indian Vampire if you're going to go way back. But there's Sammy dropping some film knowledge on you guys. I don't normally do that much anymore, but if you really want to go search out Indian Vampire, go ahead. But it's interesting that this is, you know, you got Mario Adorf, who's Italian / German. You got Robert Hussein, who's French. Mm-hmm. And then Giovanna Raleigh, who's she's in the film. She's obviously Italian. And then Chico, mm-hmm. I believe that actor may have been German.
Hans Neubert, yeah.
Yeah, he may have been German. But again, this is an era where world cinema, like I said, is kind of becoming a thing. So I think people were casting faces and they're looking to make their budget back. And I think Hussein was definitely on the precipice of what was going to become a big genre. Just a couple years later, it would become huge. Mm-hmm. And then they'd make, you know, 700 or something spaghetti westerns in like a decade. And then they would just die. So they'd run it into the ground, essentially. But this is interesting to go back and watch this. Now, I had never seen this. So both films this week I had never seen. I had heard of this, Le Goût de la Violence. I had heard of this, but I had never seen it. And the reason why I'd heard of it is because, and this is where my memory is kind of embarrassing, but I believe we covered Cemetery Without Crosses.
I don't think so. I know I didn't with you. I know you had spoken about it when you saw it.
Yeah, maybe we did see it. Or maybe we did cover it. Maybe we didn't. That's kind of sad that I don't know that. And I guess I could Google that, but I haven't even tried. But I think we did. But again, we've done so many films on the show. I mean, you think about the length, you know, 443, 450 episodes, two films per. I mean, you're talking about 1,000 movies at this point that we've talked about in detail. And even though that doesn't touch the history of cinema, it's, you know, less than 1% probably, it's still a lot of movies. And at mm-hmm. some point, you know, my brain power is not what it used to be. But I think what I pulled away from this more than anything was just that kind of that early kind of structure of the spaghetti western. This is basically an escort movie, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, you got three characters and a hostage, and you're trying to get them from point A to point B.
It's Midnight Run, but in Central America.
Yeah. And it's essentially just a simple story. So whenever you want to do, in my opinion, whenever you want to do a simple western or even a simple story in any way, in a modern take, you can put them in a car. But in this, you know, you got on horseback or sometimes not on horseback. It just depends. And you just move them across, and then you have interactions in between. Speaking of Craig Zoller or whatever, you can talk about Bone Tomahawk, or you can talk about any number of movies, really, because this is a standard story element. Mm-hmm. I think what the key here is I think Hossein became a better director. This is a very simple directing style, but there is some style here. There's some horrific elements. There's some surrealistic elements. And it's kind of interesting in that way, that it's kind of playing with the genre a little bit.
Well, and I think that is the thing that makes Hussein interesting. I've only seen these two films of his. I am insanely interested in seeing what was it? Secret Killer, about the Vampire of Dusseldorf.
Oh yeah.
Because you know, you talk about it having a very simple style, and I agree that it's a very simple style. I also would say that it is also very thoughtful, and this is extremely inventive low-budget filmmaking. Mm-hmm. You get the opening ambush of the train where, you know, he actually has the train with all these guys on it and the sandbags and the soldiers and the machine guns, and then he just shows you his smoke for the ambush, and then everybody's dead.
Yeah.
I find that interesting. I find it interesting that he would do that. He would spend the money and the time and everything else with the train, but then not show you the action beat. So again, we go back to that, you know, kind of like we were saying about the big knife, not, you know, keeping certain things off screen. And the choice of doing that, I think, is really interesting. And then I think that it's very interesting the way that Hossein is not afraid to, well, I think that he, from what I've gathered of him, and again, having only seen the two, he is a guy who really is interested in looks that characters give people, because his movies are filled with people giving people looks, and all of these looks all have a lot of meaning. And I think that's the key to these two films, or this film certainly. You take a character like Giovanni Rawley, who barely speaks in the entire movie, but man, you can see just from the way she's watching these guys, and she'll kind of like give a little smirk, or she'll kind of like, you know, her eyes will kind of narrow a little bit, and you can see that there is a shrewdness, fierceness, as well as having a certain vulnerability, because she's a very pious woman. So she, you know, she's a religious person. So that kind of, you know, shows a little bit different side of a person who is not above being calculating.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like I said, I mean, that is really... I mean, a lot of this movie takes place with very little dialogue. He's telling you the absolute essentials with the dialogue for the most part. The only character who really talks a lot is Adorf. And that's only because he has to talk a lot, because that's, you know, who he is. Mm-hmm. He is not a guy who, you know, is necessarily for La Revolution or whatever. He is a guy who is a lot more like the other people in the film, you know, because it's very... Hossein is very smart to just not have it be, well, there's the guerrillas who are fighting for the peasants, and the peasants love the guerrillas against this dictator. No. There's the dictator, there's the guerrillas, and then there's the peasants, and they all have different ideas about what they want out of life.
Yep.
And he's very keen to show you that, and he's very keen to show you that very visually. There's that fantastic scene, I think, when he walks into the village with all the huts that are kind of like set down low past this dirt path. And, you know, he just walks into the village and all these people just start following him, one after the other, until he's got like a caravan behind him. And then that plays into the next scene, or I should say a couple scenes down the road then, where... you know, the villagers show back up again because they're like, hey, we want to, you know, kind of have a little chat with you about something, even though they say pretty much nothing. But you know exactly what they want. And, you know, they go about trying to get it. And that to me is what I really, really, really love about Hossein and his style. And he manages to make it intriguing the entire way through, because a lot of times when a movie has very limited or little dialogue, I tend to find my mind wandering to the point that I start going to sleep because of the silence. Not with this guy, or at least not yet. I find his movies fascinating and really involving and really, really well paced. So there's that. Just to kind of kick it off.
Yeah, that scene you're talking about, yeah, that is almost like a zombie-esque type mm-hmm, of moment. Mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, horror without any real horror taking place. And the overbearing sound of corn stalks being walked through.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you're into that kind of thing, this is the movie for you. Right now. This is the movie you'll love.
Uh-huh.
So, but, yeah, the other thing, that sounds like somebody's upstairs. Here we go.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, they'll be be toys brought downstairs in a minute here. I just have a Easter Bunny has arrived.
Anyway, but yeah, I mean, you were talking about. No, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think what you're seeing with Hossein is it's kind of similar. I think it might have been some of the stuff he learned from, you know, working on something like Rafifi, where you know he was in that film, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. that silence can be golden sometimes in cinema. That sometimes a lot more is said with a look than with, you know, actual dialogue. And then I think that's what the stylists of Italian cinema, I think that's kind of one of the things that they brought to cinema was that, you know, what certainly what Leone brought was that stillness and silence can be just as powerful as, you know, a soliloquy recited by Rod Steiger. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the key. And so, and with that comes casting of faces and stuff. And Hossein was smart. He cast faces. Of course, you can't go wrong if you cast Mario Adorf, who has one of the most unique faces. And he great. You know, actually, I was thinking about this. If they ever made a, which they would never do this, but if they ever made a Mario Adorf biopic, I think Alfred Molina would be a pretty good Mario Adorf. I think he could pull that off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
He reminds me of Molina sometimes. Or of Adorf sometimes, Molina does, in some of the ways he's able to, you know, he's English / Spanish, and he can play mm-hmm. all types of different roles, and he's kind of, he scared me. He's kind of malleable that way. There's my son. He's down around here. I guess he got up extra early this morning. You just woke up. It's only 7? It's only 8. What's that?
I don't know. I just
found it. Yeah. It's a fat head. Yeah. So I'll have to open it up here in a little bit. Did you get some other stuff there?
Yeah. All right. Bring it in that room.
Okay. All right. I'll be done in a minute.
Also, I got Kyrie Irving shoes.
Kyrie Irving shoes?
Yeah.
All right.
I got Kyrie Irving.
All right. I'll be done in a minute. He's so proud.
Hey.
I'm a little man.
There you go.
All right. But yeah, so to get into some more of that stuff, so I always like the escort movies. I like when you put a couple characters together, two or three characters together. And I think also the Adorf character, to kind of go back to what you're talking to, he's kind of the voice of reason in an unreasonable situation. I think you always got to have that, right? Like he realizes that they're in bad shape. And if that the longer they go, the worse shape they're going to get in.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting, and especially, you know, comparing this now to The Big Knife, and you just brought that up, and it reminded me that you have the two characters, you know, and this idea of idealism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it was crushed out of Palance, it's the fire that keeps the Hossein character going. Is this sort of this ideal that, you know, he can, you know, work to free the country, and then you know, as the film goes on, then obviously, you know, certain things come up and yeah, maybe not so much. But yeah, it, you know, road trip movie or not road trip movies, but escort movies, it's got that classic Stockholm syndrome sort of deal going on, right?
Yes.
Cause she's like the rich upper class kind of woman and, it doesn't quite play out how you expect it to, although it does to a certain degree.
Well, yeah. And then there's some elements of the film that are, again, it's a little bit of what's the story I'm trying to think? Is it Paradise Lost? No, it's not Paradise Lost. It's I can't remember the basis of it off the top of my head, but you know what I'm talking about. The Apocalypse Now type thing.
Oh, Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, there you go, Heart of Darkness. It's that, Jesus, you know, one of the most influential stories of all time, and I can't remember the title. But it's got that element to it. There is a bit of a Heart of Darkness to it that, you know, the further they go with this, the worse it's going to get.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. We'll get this stuff opened in a little bit.
I'm gonna bring down one more thing.
Okay. Anyway, there's the that element to it. And as the film progresses, there's more and more of that. So and it kind of coincides with, you know, fires and random beach crucifixion. It's crucifixion? I guess that is crucifixion.
Crucifixion.
But mm-hmm. it's not, I mean, it's not random, so to speak, but it does kind of come out of nowhere, right? And there's these kind of horror elements to it. Not horror in the sense that you're used to, but that's what I pulled away from this movie was that, you know, the title, the fact that they've had this taste of violence, and now their whole lives are kind of surrounded by this violence. Mm-hmm. And they've made this choice. They've made this choice to do this deed. And in doing so, they've kind of sealed their fate. Mm-hmm. But the way it plays out, I got to be honest with you, the back end of the movie really kind of surprised me in some ways. There was some nice surprises at the back end.
Yeah. Hossein, he really seems to like these fatalistic, you know, almost apocalyptic sort of stories. They feel apocalyptic. They feel doomed. There's the great scene where they're walking down like an exterior street, and you know, all alongside them are these guys that are hung. It's just, it's nightmarish.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that's one of the things that he finds interesting is this idea that, life is brutal. And it's, you know, these little things that you kind of have to, cling to, or lose, or give up for that matter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, civility only exists because of violence, right? I mean,
sure.
There's no, you wouldn't have a civil lifestyle, a normal lifestyle, if violence did not establish that lifestyle. Otherwise, we'd all be savages. Mm-hmm. Because that's, you know, basically what Kubrick was saying with 2001 stuff. You know, once we got a taste of violence, we became dominant. Once we became dominant, we, you know, established a way of life. And whether
same with Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, so. And whether anybody wants to admit it or not, the only reason why you have a good sense of life is because somebody, you know, basically made the decision to destroy some things and establish some power. Now, I'd like to believe that human beings are capable of just being good things all around, but I don't believe anything comes from, I think all the good things about us come from bad things. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's my perception. And I think Hossein kind of feels the same way. I think that all the good in a human person, love, kindness, regret, all these type of things that make us very human, I think come from an established sense of violence. And I think this is the age-old question of cinema and storytelling is, you know, you hear this question a lot, is the violence necessary and stuff? But unfortunately, we are a violent species. Mm-hmm. And we like to not talk about it. We like to keep it in the closet, so to speak. But almost everything we have in our lives is established by some type of violence in some way, shape, or form.
Well, it doesn't even have to be physical violence.
No, it doesn't.
You know, it doesn't have to be. It could be, you know, an emotional violence. It could be.
Yeah. It's all there. And I don't want to get too deep into it. Obviously, my son's around stuff. I don't need him, you know, pontificating on the acts of violence in America at this point in time in his young life. But it is there. And I think that this doesn't go that deep, but it had me thinking of that. It had me thinking of how one act of violence can, you know, nowadays we got PTSD we talk about and everything, and all these things we know more about the human brain, but how violence can both be useful and useless, and how it's one of those complicated things, like love, that makes us different maybe than the average creature. Maybe the average creature is obviously creating or procreating for survival, whereas maybe we are as well. Hang on a second. I'm getting asked a question again. All right. He's in here with a sleep mask of some sort on.
Ooh.
Don't bump into anything, please. All right. Give me a few minutes and I'll be done here. All right. But, that's the kind of thing I got away from. I pulled away from it. And I usually do pull that away from films with violent content. I mean, obviously there are films where the violent content that I'm watching for that visceral response and just for the fact that I'm safe watching violence. When I think about, you know, slasher films, I love slasher films because they're violent. And I'm safe sitting on my couch watching that violence happen. But I also am repulsed by violence completely when it's told in a more realistic context, such as in some ways, a Dragged Across Concrete, because that film repulsed me in so many ways. because it's dealing with violence in that ugly way that makes me uncomfortable. And that's what I want. I don't know why, but that we got to stop talking about that movie. People are going to think we love it.
I didn't even love it.
Yeah, and I didn't even love it. So we got to stop talking about that.
So I was saying, dragged across concrete.
No, yeah.
I'm kidding.
I see. You got a Texas hat? Or Tennessee hat? Tennessee hat. Okay. All right. But so one of the interesting things, we got to say this. Okay, we got to bring this up because I brought this up to you in the messaging app. This transfer on Prime, I don't know if that's the one you watched or not.
Yeah, yes it is.
It's very muddy and very soft, and I kept thinking to myself, man, this looks like a VHS recording of either another VHS tape or off a TV. And then somewhere along the way, the word stereo pops up in the bottom right-hand corner.
Well, you also get like the tracking every now and again.
And I think, to myself that, man, that reminds me of my old VCR in so many ways.
Yep. And so if you're nostalgic for watching stuff on VHS, this is the movie for you.
Yeah, this is the transfer you want to watch.
Uh-huh.
It certainly got that feel. But I thought that. I was like, man, this is murky. It looks like it comes off of like a bad VHS dub copy, and boom, there it was. And which is fine. I mean, it's not like I've ever been averse to watching VHS dub copy. Sometimes when you watch the films we watch, you don't really have much choice because a lot of stuff isn't available on DVD. And this, as far as I know, is not available on any DVD or Blu-ray anything.
Not that I'm aware of. No.
So this is the way you get to watch it. But it almost feels like Amazon doesn't realize that they might have a bootleg on their on their site, or this might be the only format that you can get this movie in at this point. I mean, for all I know, I mean, this is very early in Spaghetti Western cycle, so I don't know, you know, how well preserved this film is, or if it's seen as important. I think it should definitely be looked upon now as being more important than it was. And like I said, I really like the story. I like the acting is all good from everybody. The scenes, there's a couple memorable scenes, no doubt. The story itself is very good. The ending really packs a wallop, I got to say. Both of our films this week have some great endings. We can't argue with that. I mean, both of them kind of save their, you know, the blast they're going to hit you in the face with, for lack of a better, I just realized what I said there out loud. But they save that for the end. And I like that. I also like the constant sound of wind in this film. It almost gives it an otherworldly feel.
Yep.
Which is kind of a nice touch, right? I mean, I like that. You know, constantly all you hear is...
Yep. Yeah, well, that's kind of what I refer to when I'm talking about, you know, how Hussein does these sort of apocalyptic sort of things. Yeah. It's just wasteland.
It is literally, I mean, I'd be amazed if he wasn't familiar with Heart of Darkness, because some of the films he's directed, they feel like a journey into madness. They feel like a journey into the interior of a character who's made a bad decision and now has to live with the consequences. And I think that there's something very human about that, because I think that's something we all struggle with at some point. I think we, as human beings, I think we lie to ourselves a lot and tell ourselves that everything's going to be okay so we can survive. But the reality is, and this is maybe a little too dark for some people to hear, the reality is, just like owning a dog, those stories never end well. Somebody's going to go. And it's the reality of us, and I think it's what makes us human, is that we realize that. But I'm going to kick it over to you, because I'm getting hit with the parlay of stuff in the background. But go ahead and let me know
what you think. I haven't got a whole lot else to really add. I think we've talked about the vast majority of what this movie's doing and how it's doing it. You get this great scene in the back end where he goes to his sister's place, and man, does she let him have it.
yes, she does.
It's great. You know, cause it's just a completely different angle from everything that we've been seeing up until then.
He's not going back to dinner at that place anytime soon.
Yeah, no, Sunday dinners at Perez's house are not, you know, not all sunshine. Yeah. But and yet, you know, his sister and then his fiance are the end result of all the fighting that's going on, you know, no matter who wins. And I found it really interesting that, you know, he treats his fiance like she is just completely a thing that was expected of him to do. And he has no real intention of ever having pretty much anything to do with her. except maybe, you know, have kids if they ever get married. That's pretty much all she's there for. It was, I found that really kind of fascinating, how throwaway it was. Because I think that, that even in that sort of aspect, I think he's saying a little bit more about this guy and the situation of this country and all this sort of thing. The country, which I don't believe they actually ever named the country. It's not an actual, you know, a named country.
No, no, it's just some
Latin, random Central American.
Yeah, some Central American Latin-based country.
Yeah, yeah. I think
obviously, though, there's probably some commentary, right, on either France or something.
Well, I was thinking along the lines of de Gaulle and you know, the whole French Resistance sort of thing, because there were, you know, French filmmakers were still very much getting hard into their experiences, and I don't know what Hossein's experiences during World War II were. If any, but you know, to talk about these things through genre films, certainly he and, you know, Melville, just to name two. But I think that's at least part of it is what was rolling around in the back of my head. Although I couldn't be more specific than that because I'm, you know, not the world's biggest history buff. And so let's see. So the film does get a little like forcefully artsy, towards the end there with the the love connection sort of sequence that goes on, you know, with them like laying there on the beach and it's like a double exposure of the ocean and all this sort of thing. It really, I don't know that I would have left that in there were I the filmmaker on this thing, because it just, it really does feel like it kind of prize its way in there,
right?
And then just kind of lays there and says, "Okay, here we are. Now this happened."
Yeah.
That doesn't work. And then the film, you know, kind of like The Big Knife again. You know, the correlations between these two films are really starting to stack up here.
Yeah.
The film doesn't really have a finale per se. You know, things happen off screen, and then it's just over. And I think that at least partly for me, it robs the film of a little bit of an emotional impact. Not that I needed it to go big.
No.
But I needed some sort of catharsis. So I don't know if Hossein is either really, really clever in that way or whether it was just a not great decision on his part, or possibly one forced by economics.
Yeah, the stoicness of the ending is, I don't know, a bit shocking, and maybe that's why it works for me, but it certainly is not going to work for everybody.
No, I don't think it will. Although I do think that this is a film that a lot of people should see, frankly.
Yeah, especially if you're a fan of spaghetti westerns, because I think it's interesting. I don't know if I didn't get any Leone-esque type moments out of this or nothing.
No, not really. It's not really. It's more a Jean Rollin spaghetti western than it is a Sergio Leone.
Yeah, I think they call these the French ones. They call them baguette westerns.
Yeah. That's exactly it. But I, you know, it's interesting. And this is what Shiftless brought up when he originally, you know, posed this movie to me, was that it does feel a bit like an origin story for the characters in Cemeteries Without Crosses.
Yeah, it does.
You know, from the way that they meet to the way that they end up, that the female character wears that sort of headscarf through the entire thing. His sister's house looks almost exactly like the Mercier characters in Cemeteries Without Crosses or Cemetery Without Crosses. Mm-hmm. You know, there really are a lot of similarities. You could easily make connections between the two if you really want to. So. Yeah, there's that. That's all I got. Yeah, I really dug this thing a lot. Not as much as Cemetery, but it was really, really rock solid.
Yeah, no, I think so.
For those of you, you know, it kind of reminds me a little bit in feel of Orson Welles' stuff that he was doing, you know, post Kane, when he would just kind of be scrabbling together money.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And it has that sort of a feel to it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Cemetery has that feel a little bit as well, but of course that would
a little bit, but that's more polished.
Yeah. Well, I think Hossein became a better filmmaker. I mean, you're talking 8 years later.
Yeah, sure.
So I think he became a better filmmaker by the time he gets to Cemetery. Really am curious. I really, really am curious if we've covered Cemetery Without Crosses at this point. I feel like we have. I just don't know anymore. I can't keep up with it myself. I can't keep up with the own show that I've created, you know?
Well, let's look.
I don't know if I want to know, to be honest with you, because I feel like I have, and if I find out we haven't, I'm going to be like really bothered by that.
Let's see. Blood Diner, Blue Bone, Boogans. Oh, God, Boogans.
I see. That's another
one. I forgot that one.
I forgot what kind of Boogans.
Yes, you did.
Oh, we did. So there you go. I wonder if I was on the show. I feel like I was.
I know I wasn't. Yeah, because I haven't seen that movie until like now.
Yeah.
So
crazy.
So there you go. It was covered. It was film number 720.
Oh, so that's not too far, not too long ago.
No.
Maybe not. Yeah, well, okay. Wonder what episode it was. Isn't it sad? Isn't it sad, folks, to listen to the deterioration?
I'm still pissed you guys covered Chud without me.
Yeah.
But, what are you going to do?
Well, we still got Chud, too. We can still do that. We still talk about Bud the Chud.
Talking about dragging across concrete. Hey, how are you?
I don't remember. Maybe I did. Maybe that was an episode I missed. That's the other problem, right? Is life has kind of kicked us in the pants a couple of times, and sometimes Will and I are like, "Yeah, we covered that film," and then we go back and look, and we're like, "Oh yeah, I wasn't on that episode. I watched the movie, but I didn't get ever a chance to get on the episode." That happens to us so much. I'll be like, reaching out to Todd and be like, "Yeah, what are we gonna cover?" Me and Will be talking, be like, "Yeah, let's cover this." I'm like, "Okay, man." I watched those two films, and then come the day we record, I'm like, "Yeah, I can't do it, guys." And it's like, "Yeah, we covered that. I remember I watched it. And I'm like, "Wait a minute. I never spoke about it publicly." So who knows? Who knows what I thought? Maybe I wasn't on that. Who knows? Okay. Is that all you really pretty much got? I mean, this is a very solid film. I can see why Shiflis recommended it because I can see it's very GGTMC and it's kind of influences. And obviously Mario Adorf's in there, who's well-beloved here on the show. And he is good. I'm not going to lie. There's a really good performance by him in the film. And I really like his kind of voice of reason because he's just, you know, the Chamaco character is just being honest. He's just, you know, like, "Hey, you know, dude, at some point we got to realize we got a situation here."
It was episode 351.
Whoa. It's only about 100 episodes ago.
I know, right? So that's what, 3 years?
Yeah, really. Wow.
2015. So,
yeah.
August 2015.
4 years. Man, where'd the time go? Whoa. Was I on that episode? That's the next question.
I know I wasn't. At least I don't think I was. Yeah, because I didn't do Contamination with you guys.
Is that the other film we did?
Yeah.
Oh, yep. I was on that episode. I remember talking about it.
It was, let me think here. Spider Baby, Cemetery Without Crosses, and Contamination. That was actually a threefer.
Wow. Pulled off a threefer that week, huh?
The hell? I couldn't do that now if I tried.
Those are the old days. Yikes.
All that pep.
I'm looking through, scrolling through our page back when we actually were able to put pictures on the thing. You can't do that anymore. It's like it's all messed up now. I should work harder on the show. I'll just be honest with you. We should, but I just don't have time. So just be happy we can get it out at this point because those of you who follow Will on Facebook, I'm sure you know he's going through a lot right now. So it's a tough time. Yeah, Spider Contaminated Cemetery. Yeah, there you go. Did I spell cemetery wrong in that episode?
Yes.
I think I did.
Yeah, I spelled it with an N.
Yeah, cemetery.
Yes.
Nice. Nothing better than a misspelled. Nothing better than going back and looking at something like that and making you feel like total shit. I will try to remember to go. There's a part of me that wants to leave it up for the charm.
I'll leave it. The hell.
Cemetery. Yeah. You know, and I'm a stickler for double checking spelling too. Anyway, all right, let's get into. You want to get into MVTs and make or breaks?
Because I got. We can absolutely do
I
that.
Got children moving around. I can hear things now.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
That I didn't before, but now I have multiples.
Uh-oh.
All right. MVT. This one's easy for me. This is Hussein. Because he's directed this. He wrote this. He stars in this. He's pretty good. He's, like I say, he's very stoic, as he tends to be. But he's good in the film. I did like Adolf a lot, though. I want to give him a, you know, a special MVT prize in a way. Not to open up a can of worms and say we now have a special supporting MVT category. But he is really good in the movie. So if you love Mario Adolf, you're going to love him in the movie. He's really, really good. Make or break. I don't see how you can't go with the cornfield scene. There is some other good moments. I really like the ending, even though it is very stoic, and I did like the beach scene. I certainly didn't like the artsy flashback love scene. I'm with you on that piece. Yep. I'm gonna go with cornfield. I like all that build up. I like all that sound, that Foley work. I like all that stuff. So. I'll go with that. My score for the film, 7 out of 10. I liked it quite a bit. I mean, it's good. I didn't like it as much as I liked The Big Knife. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if a little bit, if I'd have had that Blu-ray I wonder this sometimes. If I'd have had that crisp Blu-ray presentation, if I'd have liked this just as much. I want to say no, because I like the acting in Big Knife more. So for me, that's worth the 0.5. But I did like this quite a bit. And I think it's certainly for anybody that's a film buff. They need to check out Taste of Violence.
All right, cool. Well, I mean, we are spot on just about. So, MVT is definitely Hussein, same reason that you said. Make or break, yes, it's the cornfield scene. I thought that it is tense as all get out. And I love that, there's no dialogue for a lot of it and no music.
A lot of wind.
And the sound of fire and corn burning.
It's not a Mel Brooks movie, so it's not Breaking Wind. It's just
yes, no beans in this one. The cornfield scene and score for me. I'm a little bit higher than you. I'm a 7.5 out of 10.
Okay,
I did like this more than The Big Knife.
Nice,
and I absolutely would highly recommend this, even in this abhorred
it's bad,
terrible fucking transfer that's on Amazon. I would still recommend it highly to anyone.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the good news is it's watchable.
Oh yeah, it's
and you know, I've certainly seen worse, but it's certainly watchable. I think this film would. I'm actually surprised in a way that some label hasn't picked this up. But maybe, maybe there's not a good transfer of it out there. I mean, maybe there's not. I mean, you could probably.
Well, it's a Gaumont film, so I would imagine there's some decent elements somewhere. But you know, what do I know?
I'd like for them to put. I'm actually surprised somebody like Arrow hasn't put this out, to be honest with you. So.
You never know. Never say never.
All right. So that is the big show. Thanks, Shiftless, for the recommendation. It's always fun to see something that we didn't know about. That's always fun. I have to cut this ending here as short as I can because, like I say, pitter patters. Now I'm hearing dogs. So now the house is awake. So no more blast in the face comments. That's going to be the big show for this week. Again, always support Arrow Video as much as possible because they're putting out great stuff. And always support all of our listeners and the recommendations, like Shiftless, who brought up something, like I said, we hadn't seen. So thank you, sir. No, we don't do feedback on the show much anymore. Well, at all, because we just don't flat have time. This had to be a full-time job to handle feedback. Jesus. But thank you for all those who still send emails and things like that. I still read them. Just don't always answer them. But know that they're read. I try to answer them if I can. But some of them are open-ended, so I feel like they're not really an answer needed. But know that I've read them. I'm sure Will has as well. That should be it. I don't know what we're doing next week. We'll figure that out as we go, as we tend to do. And I got to reach out to Diabolic. That reminds me. Jeez, see? You just don't realize how much stuff you forget daily until you sit down and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll figure it out. Until then, I will say adios.
Adios.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.
Thank you.